Nate from New Jersey. It's the SNL Nerds, the show with two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
And I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
John Trumbull, how are you doing, good sir?
Yeah, I'm doing all right, you know, getting by. Doing okay. How are you doing?
Good, good. I just got my first dose of a little thing they call the vaccine. I feel okay. No side effects. My mutant powers have not kicked in just yet. So you know, we'll see what happens. Maybe I'll wake up being able to shoot lasers out of my eyes. Fingers crossed. Or you know, maybe I'll be able to shoot webbing from my wrists. I don't know. I really don't know.
So you really just want to shoot something out of some body part? I'm guessing.
Yes, that's the dream. I could get blue here, but I won't.
You could.
That's low hanging fruit, and we ain't about that here at this podcast.
We're not?
I mean, we are. But
not like 2 minutes in.
Yeah, we're not like some shock jocks. We're not Opie and Anthony or nothing.
Right.
But what was I saying? Oh, yeah, mutant powers. But yeah, so that's what I am hoping for, being able to shoot something out of my body, you know, insert dirty joke here, or the gift of flight. That would be kind of cool, too.
Flight, that would be a good one to have. Flight,
yeah, have you
super
have you thought
speed,
about this?
Those would be fun. The eye lasers, that would be really tempting to use in the wrong way, you know?
Yeah, I hear
that would be a dangerous one to have.
That might turn you into a villain.
Yeah.
And also, like, I know that, like, if you know, guys have this conversation quite a bit where it's like, what kind of superpowers would you want? Anytime a guy says they want to, like, would like to have invisibility powers or be invisible, people kind of look at them like, oh, he's going to do creepy shit with it.
Yeah, I mean, invisibility as a power, I mean, it's pretty much built for the creepy stuff.
Yeah, like whenever somebody says, I want to be invisible, you're like, oh, you nasty.
But the thing is, with invisibility, it's no good unless you can also turn your clothes invisible. Because otherwise you have to go everywhere naked, and that really cuts down on the possibilities.
Yeah, if you have like body image issues, then you don't even make... Being invisible, walking that street naked, that you maybe feel self-conscious.
Because like you'd have to go somewhere, find a secluded place, turn invisible, then strip down, and then you know do whatever invisible stuff you were planning to do.
Yeah,
spying on somebody, I'm assuming.
Yeah, what if you're somewhere chilly?
Exactly.
What if you're in Minnesota? You can't do that shit.
So it would be a superpower you could only use in temperate climates, and that's no good.
Yeah, it's like, oh, I can be invisible, but I can't leave Miami.
What if it rains?
Yeah, then you're all soaking wet. You got to get a towel.
Then you're wet. Then you're like an invisible person who is just outlined by the raindrops.
You know what? The more I think about it, the more I don't like it. You know, fuck invisibility.
So, yeah, unless you could turn your clothes invisible, that would be the game changer for that.
That's the dream. You got to have that Harry Potter cloak, the invisibility cloak.
There you go. That's what you want. Ooh. Yeah, you want the Harry Potter cloak and a boarding school. That would be a dangerous place to have the invisibility power.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah. Unless you're, yeah.
You would get expelled from that boarding school very, very quickly is what I'm saying.
You could be, like, especially if you're, like, too old to be at that boarding school, then that's where the creepy factor comes in yet again.
Yeah. But, I mean, if you're just, like, in the budding puberty thing, and then, that's dangerous. It's like, oh, here, 14 to 16-year-old boy, have a cloak of invisibility.
Yeah, then it's...
Don't go for to the girls' wing. Wink, wink.
Yeah, that's when you get into that Porky's... wacky hijinks / slight sexual badness.
Yeah, Do they have a separate wing for the girls in the Harry Potter books? I don't even know. Or are they just full co-ed?
I imagine they gotta, right?
I don't know.
That's a good point. I would imagine they would, but I don't think they ever brought it up. It was just Slytherin and Hufflepuff and Ravenclaw and Zippity Doodah or whatever.
So are they? They're housed by their magical houses then.
Yes, but I don't know if they're divided within that house.
Yeah,
although they should be.
They should be.
Now I think about it.
So that's like eight dorms we're talking about then.
Yeah, it's huge. It ain't, it's like NYU. It ain't no small little community college.
Or they could do what they did in my college, where it was like they alternated floors. Like the first floor was a girl's floor, the second floor was a guy's floor.
Oh, that, you know what, that makes sense.
They could do that. That's pretty simple.
That would make sense. I like how we get into this magical architecture segment of the show.
Yeah, yeah. Huh. So anyway, that's good that you got the vaccine.
These tangents are my favorite part of the show. Because like we started about one thing. I started talking about getting the vaccine, and now we're talking about Harry Potter.
Exactly.
I mean, my lord.
Exactly. Yeah, and we don't plan it. It just happens.
That's right. This is all sweet, sweet improv, baby.
That's right. That's right. And speaking of sweet, sweet improv.
Hey.
This week we are covering a documentary about one of the original Not Ready for Primetime players, Gilda Radner. It's the 2018 documentary Love, Gilda, directed by Lisa DiAppolito.
I thought you were going to say Lisa Loebner, and I was like, I got a little excited.
That would be impressive, wouldn't it?
Yeah. It's like Lisa Loebner directed this? And action.
Todd!
You're in the shot.
You're in your shot, Todd.
God.
You pointed out that this was on the Hulu. Neither one of us had seen this, so we were like, hey, let's check it out.
Yeah, I think I did see this because this came out. I remember this debuting on CNN of all places.
Really?
Because I think it was like Magnolia Films, made it, and then I think maybe they were connected to like CNN Films or CNN Documentaries. Because I do remember watching this on TV, and it debuted on CNN back in September of 2018, and I probably mentioned it on this podcast that I saw, but we never like really got too deep into it. I think we like. You know, we kind of grazed it and talked about it a little bit, but this is the deep dive, people.
Yes. So it was my first time watching it, so I guess it was the second time around for you.
Yeah, but like again, like I don't remember. I didn't remember much of it, so to quote Foreigner, it feels like the first time.
Oh, look at that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fairly short documentary. I think it was only like, 87 minutes, something like that?
Yeah, it's like 90 minutes or so, hour and a half, really quick, in and out. I mean, I guess we'll just dive into it because I don't think there was too much to this one. But in my mind, I was kind of comparing it to the Belushi documentary that we had talked about a few months ago, that aired on Showtime, because it does kind of have the same thing where this documentary has like handwritten letters and some audio tapes that, Gilda wrote and, audio tapes that she spoke into and did. So we hear a lot of things being done in her voice. And one thing that the director did that I really enjoyed is that she actually had modern day SNL cast members and former cast members read the letters. And that was an interesting touch.
Yeah. Yeah. The director, Lisa DiAppolito, she got from Gilda Radner's brother, Michael, she got a collection of boxes and stuff that had been in storage since she died. And she says in the boxes were photos, journals, and 32 hours of audio cassette tapes she recorded in order to write her book. Gilda Radner, she wrote a book called, an autobiography called It's Always Something. Which actually I learned from this documentary came out just 2 weeks after she unfortunately passed away from ovarian cancer.
Right. Yeah. That was a bummer. And that book was number one New York Times bestseller as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Apparently it's never been out of print either, which I didn't realize. But she had all these journals and photos and 32 hours of audio cassette tapes. So, it's always nice to hear about like a person's journey in their own words. And it was neat to hear people like Amy Poehler and Melissa McCarthy and Maya Rudolph and Bill Hader and Cecily Strong reading on it. Bill Hader in particular, he seemed like very tickled. He was like, oh, this is an honor to do this.
Yeah. I like that. You could tell that's another reason I like Bill Hader so much. Like, you can tell he's like a big comedy nerd, like us. Like he was like there. Like you said, there was one segment where he was like, "No, this is really huge for me. Thank you so much." Like, you can tell.
Bill Hader's a generally good guy.
Yeah, like he acts how probably one of us would act if like we got asked to read letters from Gilda Radner or, you know, Phil Hartman or somebody we admired from SNL that passed away.
Yeah. I mean, that would be something else. I mean, he seemed really touchy. And like Amy Poehler talked about how Gilda was a particular inspiration to her. And she was like, yeah, I ripped off most all of Gilda's characters when I was on the show.
Yeah, I think she said like her and Emily Spivey, one of the former writers, that like whenever they were getting stuck writing a sketch, they were like, they just put in an old Gilda performance. And then we're like, they say, yeah, we just did like a kind of a second rate version of what Gilda was doing.
Mm-hmm. Which, that's a way to go. Worked once. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I mean, the doc, it starts out, there's a little bit about her childhood, not a whole lot, but enough to give you context, I would say, right?
Yeah. I mean, we find out she was, she grew up in Detroit. Her brother, Michael, they also mentioned that like, they're pretty affluent growing up. Like they were well to do.
Yeah. They said, her dad was in the hotel apartment business. So they were okay money wise. Her dad had her kind of late in life. Her dad was like in his 50s.
Yeah, that was crazy. It's like, whoa. Mm-hmm. And also this was the time when Detroit was like a booming metropolis. Like, I think people don't remember, like, Detroit for a while was like a happening city. It was like up there with New York, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
For a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, because, you know, that was the auto industry was there. So, yeah, it was a big boom town. You know,
right.
It was, and this is back in the 50s before people were buying foreign cars.
That's right. And so like since they were doing so well, they were able to afford to like go to Florida to summer
or for the winter months.
Winter month. I just like saying summer because I like.
Yeah.
Summer.
Yeah. She was saying that they would spend 4 months out of the year there and then she would spend like time in school down in Florida. So she I guess never went to one school for an entire academic year. And I'm just like, wow, that's something else.
Yeah, that's it's pretty interesting. And and then she also goes on to say how much humor played a big part in her family. People, you know, the family loved to laugh. They loved to, you know, get together and like from an early age, like to kind of goof around and make silly faces. Like she said, some of her early influences were Charlie Chaplin, Lucille Ball, people that were willing to like kind of risk it all and just head deep into this comedy game and just weren't afraid to look the fool in order to get the laugh.
Yeah. Yeah. And you can definitely see that in her work as well. Another thing I found striking, because they showed like several childhood photos of her. She was like a little more roly-poly as a child than you would expect. And she talks about, you hear in Gilda's own words and her voice, like her mother was concerned about her weight and they took her to a doctor and they put her on dexedrine diet pills when she was 10 years old.
Yeah. I was like, whoa, that is so fucked up.
Yeah. That is nuts. Like at 10, your mother's concerned about your weight and that she's on. I mean, okay. It's the 50s. So
yeah, it's that thing.
I would hope to think they wouldn't do that today, but
I don't know what they do today. I mean, I don't know. Like just but the issues we have in the society about women and their, you know, weight and body issues. It's like I mean it's beyond anything I can imagine. Just because, you know, I'm a dude. I don't really have to worry about that.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the pressure isn't there for guys as it is for girls, and it's terrible.
Yeah, that's very true. So, I mean, and you know, you hear this and you're just like, oh, well, that kind of formed a lot of the course of her life. Because, like, you know, one thing is, like, when you look at footage of Gilda Radner these days, you can just see how so skinny she was as an adult. And she just, she does not look healthy, you know?
Yeah, I never even noticed that until this documentary, when they mentioned this thing about her and the diet pills, where, like, now you go back and watch old episodes of SNL and you're like, oh yeah, she is, like, I just thought, oh, I guess that's, you know, just how she looks. But, like, mm-hmm. yeah, I guess it's not until I realized, like, oh, she, till this documentary where I was like, oh, I guess she had a thing with her weight. And I mean, that's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nuts. I mean, I found it very striking just looking at her in the early scenes. They also talk about her grandmother living with them,
Dibby.
Her family, like from her childhood on up, and she was like pretty inseparable from her grandmother.
Right. So her grandmother Dibby, that was her grandmother, right? Because I don't think they ever said, "Oh, this is her grandmother." I think they said it was like an older person that was part of the family. I just assumed it was a grandmother, but they never came out and said it. So I was like,
I thought they'd said it was her grandmother, but yeah, maybe I was just assuming. I don't know.
Okay. But yeah, like, her and Dibby, they had like a very strong bond, and Gilda would come to Dibby, you know, talking about how, you know, because she was a chubby kid, you know, as kids do in school, because kids are horrible, they would make fun of her and her weight and being roly-poly. And Dibby would say to Gilda, you know, if they make fun of you, just make them laugh before they can make fun of you. Like, you know, laugh along with it. And I think at that early age, she kind of realized the power of comedy, because I think she went on to say that comedy is hitting on the truth before the other guy can think of it or the other person could say it. And that was like a really kind of a light bulb aha moment for her.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's, you know, there's a lot of truth in that. I mean, you're with comedy, you're making fun of a lot of your own personal insecurities and stuff. Yeah. So,
yeah. I mean, both of us are in comedy. We've seen tons of comedians going up talking about how, you know, oh, I'm fat and blah, blah, blah. Oh, you know, not a good lover, or, you know, they like a lot of comics just like to sort of do self-deprecation just to, you know, get that laugh. And that way they have control over, you know, their lives a little bit. And like,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. You're like taking back control of it in a way. So, yeah.
Taking back the power.
Exactly. Exactly. And, let's see, also her father, was diagnosed with a brain tumor when Gilda was just 12, and then he passed away when she was 14, which,
Yeah, I think they said, like, that really kind of messed her up quite a bit. They don't really get into the dynamic of the relationship she had with her mother, but I guess because maybe it wasn't as strong as the relationship she had with Dibby and her father. But
I mean, outside of her mother being on her about her weight, no. Yeah, they don't get into it in a big way.
Right, right. But, like, yeah, so the fact that she lost her father so young, that really kind of messed with her. And, because, you know, 14, that's like your formative years. That's when you need your dad. But, I mean, unfortunately, this tragedy struck, and it really did kind of do a number on her.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's... If I have one criticism of the documentary, is I wish it went deeper in certain places. And that is a place where I wish it had gone a little deeper, you know?
Right. Yeah. Cause I mean, then they go on to say, I think it was, they showed like footage of her brother and I guess it was her sister or a friend of the family when they were looking through old photos of Gilda, and they were like, oh, that's Bob. You know, her and Gilda used to go out. Oh, that's Billy. Her and Gilda used to go out. That's Dan. Her and Gilda used to go out. Like, they kind of touch on the fact that, like, Gilda had a lot of boyfriends growing up, and she did a lot of dating, which is something we'll get into later, because Gilda's dating roster is quite impressive.
Yeah, I would say that's fair to say.
But yeah, she dates quite a number of fellas. She ended up going to an all girl private school. And like I said, she dated a lot of guys. I think she went to University of Michigan, but she never graduated because she fell in love with a Canadian sculptor.
As she did.
as you do, they're a charming bunch. And she kind of ran away with him, and like, you know, they were just away and in love. And then, yeah, that the Canadian sculptor.
and she moved to Toronto to be with the Canadian sculptor guy. And but apparently they had some problems in the in their relationship. Like he was like he wanted to be the breadwinner, it sounded like.
Yeah, it sounded like, you know, the, you know, same old tale as old as time, where the guy kind of resents the woman for being funny and, you know, kind of maybe outshining him a little bit. So he's like, hey, maybe don't be so funny and maybe don't talk as much. Just sit here in our home and, you know, make dinner and I'll be the creative.
And look pretty.
Interesting. Yeah, just look pretty. I'll be the interesting one. You can be the set dressing. How
and
about
was,
that?
You know, and this is like late 60s or early 70s. So, yeah, a lot of guys still had this attitude. I mean, not that, you know, I'm sure there are still people who have that attitude today, but it was more common in that day, I suppose.
Yeah, and it's true, because it's weird, because you think, like you said, like it's in like the late 60s, early 70s, so people would be more, like, more sensitive and open-minded and, I guess, more hippy-dippy, but there still is that kind of that old school way of thinking where it's like, oh, no, just stay home and be barefoot and pregnant, baby.
I mean, I think even, you know, that was the day of the counterculture, but I think a lot of people still had those sort of old fashioned ideas baked into them. I mean, even like we saw in the Belushi documentary, he had some of that old fashioned attitude and he certainly was sexist.
Yeah. Yeah. He was, that's another thing I'll never understand with, Belushi, because he's famous for saying women aren't funny, but then he admitted that Gilda was funny.
Right.
So I was like, by your own logic, you're not right.
He considered her the exception to the rule.
But then that doesn't make sense. If she's the exception, that doesn't that go to believe that there's other exceptions maybe to the rule? Like, I don't know.
Also, dude, you work with Gilda Radner, Jane Curtin, and Lorraine Newman. How does that disprove your argument right there? And that's not even getting into the female writers that they had, like Ann Beats and Rosie Schuster. And
yeah, like, I don't know. There was so much evidence around him that he was wrong, but he was like, nope, women aren't funny.
Yeah, I don't know. But she's up there in Toronto and she gets involved with children's theater and she eventually gets into this production of Godspell, because Godspell was the big thing. It was a big hit in New York, and they were putting together a Toronto company for it. And this production of Godspell, this is, I tell you, if I ever get a time machine, this is one of the things I would do, and I would travel back in time and see this production of Godspell. Because, okay, here's who was in the cast. Andrea Martin, Gilda Radner, Martin Short, Victor Garber, Eugene Levy, And late in the run, Dave Thomas also joined.
God damn.
Oh, Murderers. Paul Schaefer was the musical director.
Oh, yeah. That Murderers Row.
Yeah.
Murderers Row.
Yeah. I mean, that's nuts, right? Just so much talent in one production.
Yeah, it is weird how that sometimes that just happens. Just like the stars align and then you get all these incredibly talented people in the same room doing something like this. It's like you're living through history.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, you know, several of those people went on to do SCTV because of the Second City connection. And they actually showed a clip of Gilda Radner on Letterman sometime in the 80s. And she's singing Learn Your Lessons Well from the show.
Right. Yeah. Cause I think they also mentioned that like she did a singing for, she sang a song for her audition and she wasn't great. Like even she admits, like, yeah, I'm not really a singer,
right?
But like, they're still charmed by her that she got the part, and I think that's something that kind of plays out throughout her life, where she does do a lot of singing, especially in the Broadway show, which we'll get to. Mm-hmm. She does sing, and she's not a great singer; she's not technically good, but I think there's something about her, like her likability and her just like her charm, that people just like, I like her. It's not a technically good singer, but there's a lot of heart and warmth mm-hmm. in her singing and
yeah,
earnestness.
There's something very engaging about her as a performer. Martin Short, he talked about her audition song for Godspell was Zippity Doodah, which is not, that's not the typical kind of actor song.
It's not?
But apparently they just fell in love with her by the end of the song, and she was instantly cast. And she was also, they mentioned this like right up top the beginning, she was the first person cast on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, because I think after, I mean, well jumping ahead, but like I think mm-hmm. after this, she went to Second City, and yes. like she kind of became like an underground sensation, and then Lorne saw her, and like, you know, she was on Lorne's radar, and then like I think even he knew, like, you know, he said it in the doc where it's like, yeah, she's like, she's really talented, she can really do it, and she's super likable, like. People see her, they see that smile, and they're like, they're already like in love with her.
Yeah.
So I was like,
yeah.
No, I was like, no, she's got to be on the show. She's like the first one.
And while she was in this production of Godspell, she and Martin Short dated for most of the run. She's a little older than Marty Short. He was 22. She was 26.
Ooh.
And
scandal.
Yeah. You know, they talked about that a little bit. After Godspell, she goes to Second City. In Toronto, and that's where she's working with Dan Aykroyd, Joe Flaherty, John Candy.
God,
again.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, John. Wow.
Yeah. So many talented people in that bunch.
So many.
And then she, like, while she's doing, after she's doing Second City, and she talks about, they have some excerpts from her diary, and she talks about how that there she learned how to kind of stand up for herself and her material a little bit more.
Right, because I guess around that time, like, you know, women in improv, they were just getting relegated to, oh, you're a woman in improv? You can be the waitress. Or mm-hmm. you can be the sex object. You can be the whore. Or you can be, you know, the maid. Or, like, you know, they wouldn't be put in, like, kind of starring roles to really show what they could do. They would just kind of get,
right.
you know, put in, again, like this, that old school way of thinking where that's like, oh, a woman in the theater. Oh, she can be the trollop
or yeah.
the woman of the evening or
you can you know, be the can, object.
Yes, exactly. You can be object number one. That's the head object.
That's the most important object.
You'll be the lead object. That's a great part.
Yeah.
Oh, man. All right. So, yeah. So she's in Second City working with all these heavyweights. And then she kind of gets this call from a man named John Belushi.
Oh, I wanted her. Him.
Yeah. Yeah. He's done a few things. He's been around. Yeah. I think Belushi calls her to be in The Lemmings, the National Lampoon Lemmings show that we talked about a couple of old episodes. The the Belushi doc episode we talked about. And something else, I can't remember.
Fetal and Super Gesture.
That's it. Boom. And and then Belushi says, quote, do you want to be the girl in the show?
Mm-hmm.
And she was like, yeah, I'll be the girl in this show. And it's a thing. Yeah, same thing where it's like pretty much just her and just surrounded by dudes.
Yeah. So this brings us up to like 1974. So now she's in New York City. She's in Lemmings. She's working with Belushi, Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, Brian Doyle Murray, and Christopher Guest.
I mean, my God.
Yeah.
My God.
Again, it's just when, I mean, back in the day, I'm sure these were just like the people that she was working with. And yeah, everybody was talented. But like looking back on this from like 34 years on, you're just like, oh my God.
It's like you were just constantly surrounded by like the most talented people mm-hmm. known to man.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. There was a quote I really loved when they got into this era as Gilda Radner says, everything Belushi did was suicidal. And she called like his style kamikaze comedy. And I just thought, well, that sums it up. That sums up Belushi beautifully.
Yeah. Kamikaze comedy. I like that. Like,
yeah.
I'm pretty sure they kind of said something like that in the doc we watched where mm-hmm. he was just like totally gonzo, just going for it, just doing like things that had never been done before. Just
right.
And people were just in awe of it.
And she talked about how she learned to be like more forceful and get her ideas out. And because they weren't always being like, well, hey, what does Gilda think? Or Gilda, what do you want to do? So she had kind of a clever way around this. She volunteered to be the person who would like type up the ideas, and then she could just get her ideas into the script that way.
Aha. Aha. It's a pretty smart move.
Clever.
Yeah. So, guys, if you're in comedy and you want to get your ideas on a improv team or a show, take a typography class and get in through that way. You know, learn your step up your shorthand game. You know, just giving out ideas.
Yeah, exactly. And then eventually, of course, you know, Lorne Michaels comes around with Saturday Night Live, and he kind of poaches the people from the Lemmings for the cast of his new show, which was NBC Saturday Night.
I've heard of that. I've heard of it.
And Lorne is like, yeah, I knew, you know, she was the first person I cast because I knew she could do anything and she was very likable. So,
yeah,
you know, what better person to build your cast around?
Yeah, no, she was a good kind of building block to sort of start this new thing he was doing. As far as the documentary goes, I think one kind of criticism I have is I really like that thing that they were doing where they had the newer cast members and the old cast members kind of interject and say things and read the letters. But I think at this point, they kind of abandoned it a little bit. I kind of wish it was more of that.
Yeah, I would have liked to see more of Gilda in her own words. You know, apparently not all the recordings of her were usable. Like some of the tapes had degraded.
Oh, okay.
But, you know, still it's like, well, you had like 32 hours worth of stuff. You would think there would be more, but.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming they used all the best stuff, but. Who knows?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just a little nitpick I have, but you know, yeah. It's meh.
And it's interesting. They show a clip of the original cast on the Tom Snyder Tomorrow show. And you see right from the beginning how Lorne is just playing people against each other. He's like, yeah, well, we've got 8 cast members here and we're really hoping for 2 to work.
Fight.
And you know, he's just like, yeah, So it's so funny how that competitive nature of SNL was just baked into it right from the get-go.
Yeah. There can be only one.
Yeah, exactly.
Highlander. So the show goes on, and even Gilda admitted that like the first few episodes, they weren't great. I think she says they weren't so hot the first few episodes.
Yeah.
Which, you know, we saw the very first episode, listen to that old
episode of ours. We did that for our 100th episode.
We did. And but she said like around the 5th show, things start to click and mm-hmm. you start to figure out what the show is going to be.
Right. Because you know, they got the floor wax and the dessert topping.
It's a dessert topping, you cow. I don't know why that line always makes me laugh when I hear it.
Danny Aykroyd, he was good.
You cow. No one called anybody a cow anymore. I think that's it.
Yeah.
This is her topping, you cow.
It's funny because it's sexist.
It is. Oh, my Lenta. All right, so what were we doing? All right, so the show's starting to take off a little bit. They introduced some of the female writers that were on the show, Rosie Schuster and Beats. And I think they were trying to write for Gilda because I think they started to notice that people really were gravitating towards her because she's so likable and mm-hmm. affable and whatnot. So they were doing I think they also mentioned in the doc where there was one part where they had a little bit of time left that they hadn't needed to fill. So they had this segment called What Gilda Ate. And yes. They literally just put her out there and just had her talk about what she ate that day.
And she's just charming on that. She's like, well, I started out with a little dried toast and then I had a couple eggs and da, 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 da. And then the host, Rob Reiner, he like cuts her off. He's like, okay, well, thanks, Gilda. We have to do, you know, more of the show now. And then she's like, but no, I'm not done. I've got more that I ate today.
there's just something about her. It's just so charming. Like, it kind of reminds me of, like, kind of reminds me of Melissa Villaseñor a little bit. Like, she just that smile, that sort of childlike niceness and wonder. Mm-hmm. Like, I think Melissa kind of has that a little bit. I do, you know, it's just something that kind of popped in my mind. I was like, oh, yeah.
Right. Yeah, just the sheer glee that she has. And, I mean, you know, most people talking about what they ate that day would just be boring as hell. But with Gilda, it's just charming.
Yeah. The writers knew early on, there's like, you know, she could just read the phone book or just tell what she ate and people mm-hmm. be, you know, enamored with her. So let's do that. Just do a sketch of her just doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was a neat quote from Lorne Michaels where he says, like, Gilda and Chevy were the first people the audience connected with because they were basically playing themselves.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely could see that. I mean, with the exception of, you know, when Chevy does, he's playing, you know, President Ford, which, I mean, I guess is basically him.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, even then, you know, he's basically, he's more Chevy Chase than he is Gerald Ford. Cause he's not even wearing any makeup. He does nothing to make himself look like Gerald Ford.
Absolutely nothing.
You know, and it's just him being dumb and pratfall. So.
Yeah, exactly. Like the bare minimum somebody would do to look like the president they're portraying on SNL, Chevy does less than that.
Exactly. Like, you know, if he didn't say, if they didn't say in the sketches, like, this is President Ford, you would never guess.
Nope. Not at all. But yeah, so, and then also the doc kind of gets into the characters that she portrayed that kind of took off, like her Judy Miller mm-hmm. character, which is a super physical character she played. I forgot how physical it was.
Like, she was kind of the Mary Catherine Gallagher of her day. She's like, yeah, she's slamming herself into every bit of furniture on that set.
Yeah, dude, I wrote that down, Mary Catherine Gallagher, because she's like, I said, like, literally just flinging herself against the walls and bouncing off them. And I'm like, Jesus, that's got to be exhausting. I got tired just looking at her.
Yeah, yeah. And she's another one of her famous characters was Emily Latella, who was the middle-aged woman on Weekend Update, who is always, she's very hard of hearing, so she was always getting vital details of the stories wrong.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, that's kind of a character trope that they still have on Weekend Update today.
Yeah, like she talked about, why is everybody so upset about the amount of violins on television? And people are like, no, Miss Latella, it's violence.
Oh, well, that's different. Never mind.
Woo-hoo!
Woo! Yeah.
She said the catchphrase. She said it.
And she was also apparently the first person to say bitch on TV.
That's right. She shattered that glass ceiling.
So, and I guess they just considered that less objectionable because it was somebody as likable as Gilda doing it.
Yeah, I think they said, yeah, it's an old lady, so it's okay. I guess yeah. It's like the same way, like cartoon characters can get away with more stuff on their shows than, like, real-life shows can.
Mm-hmm.
I think I've heard somebody say that.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's she said the B word. Crazy. yeah, then they show some other sketches she was in, like, you know, of course, the now infamous sketch she was in with Candace Bergen, where Candace kind of flubbed the line.
And yeah. And
then she just broke and just laughed throughout the entire sketch.
Yeah, like, she calls Gilda by her character name in the sketch, and it's all the funnier because the line is, you're not very smart, are you?
Like, nope. We all, you know, we all can't be brainy like Fern here.
Yeah.
And then the audience goes nuts because, like, now
yeah.
the punchline has a different context to it, and now it's funnier
yeah.
in a different way because she is, I don't know, I always thought that was really fascinating.
Yeah, and Candace Bergen has just totally lost it, but Gilda's just rolling with it.
Yeah, Candace's just like, I'm done. I'm just going to sit back and watch all this comedy unfold.
Right, right. I liked, you know, Bill Hader was like, oh, yeah, she always seems so confident and so fearless. And, like, I was a nervous wreck for 4 years when I got here. And that's one of those quotes from somebody that just blew me away. Just because, like, you know, Bill Hader is one of the people that we think of as one of the all-time greats. I mean, he's, like, definitely in our top 10, I think.
Yeah, no, absolutely. He's a beast. But yeah, like, I have seen... If you go on YouTube and look up old Bill Hader interviews, he talks about it
very openly. He was like, yeah, I had real serious like stage fright. I had super anxiety before I had to go on every performance. It was like, it was not going away. It was really bad for like 4 years. And like after 4 years, I was able to get a handle on it, but like it was pretty nerve wracking. And then they cut to some footage about Gilda saying she kind of had the same thing too, where she was like, she was super nervous about going on, but then just as she was about to go on, like it just went away and she was like fine.
And, and she couldn't wait to get out there. She got really excited.
Right.
Which is like another quote of hers that jumped out at me was she was talking about SNL saying, she said, every Saturday is the opening night of an under rehearsed off Broadway show. And I thought, oh, well, that puts it just so beautifully.
That's pretty great.
Yeah.
It's pretty fantastic. Yeah. She has a way with words. I mean, as the show goes on, her popularity and fame start to build. She has that one character, Candy Slice, which is based off of Patti Smith, where it's super physical if you haven't seen it, but it's really pretty fantastic. And then I think they start to realize that everybody in the cast starts to realize that they're kind of a big deal when they do the Live from New York in Mardi Gras.
Yeah, the New Orleans show, the infamous New Orleans show.
Yeah, I don't really remember this. Is there still footage of it somewhere out there?
I think so. I don't know if that's like one of the SNL episodes that's on Peacock. We should check that out.
Yeah, so that was like a regular episode. That wasn't like a special or nothing.
I don't think it might have been a primetime special. I don't know, but it went like disastrously wrong. Just because like the parade that they were supposed to cover was rerouted and, you know, it's Mardi Gras. So there's all sorts of rowdy drunk people there.
In Mardi Gras? What?
Yeah. Yeah.
Huh.
And,
all right.
Yeah. There's a reason that SNL has never gone on location since.
Yeah. Like this is, I mean, I think I had heard about this. I knew vaguely about it, about them doing the show in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. But I knew it was kind of like a turning point for like the show and the cast and everything, where it was kind of infamous in that, like you said, like it was, you know, it's easier to control like a studio full of people in New York. How are you going to control streets and streets of drunken 20 somethings in the Big Easy? That's a little tougher.
I'm just wondering is like, How do you avoid have anybody like flashing on camera or something? Cause like,
yeah,
I've never been to Mardi Gras, but I understand that's a huge thing is like, you know, the women flashing for beads. So how do you prevent that from happening on live television?
I don't know. That's a good point. Yeah. Somebody's definitely got to like whip them out or whip it out. Maybe a dude whips it. Yeah.
Sure.
How do you prevent anybody from like just whipping it out and like it not being seen? I don't know. Maybe that added to it being an infamous show.
Hmm. I don't know. It's kind of weird to think that the network agreed to that.
Yeah, they did not think this all the way through.
But I guess that just shows how huge SNL was back in the day.
Yeah, because they were getting mobbed in the streets. People were like, oh, I know you guys. I know you. They were like super celebrities. Like people were like running up to Gilda and wanting to like hug her and do Lord knows what.
They were saying for the Mardi Gras show, she had to like put on a mask. Like a full face mask to like walk the streets.
Yeah. And like, I think at that point she knew, all right, something's different. Like, I'm famous now.
I'm famous.
And, yeah. Like, you know, so now they're like up in Studio 54 and getting all this VIP treatment. Cause like now they had this little ragtag crew of, you know, no names are like the top of the charts right now.
Yeah. A few more than two people hit in the cast.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say that.
I think that's safe to say. Like at least four.
Five tops.
Yeah.
Yeah, so now she's big and famous. I like this one point where she's like writes a letter to her mom about how, you know, how well she's doing and how her career is blooming. And then she writes, P.S. I am not marrying Belushi. That's just a vicious rumor.
Yeah. Oh, can't imagine that. But they do hit on her dating life. She dated Brian Doyle Murray and then she dated Bill Murray. I known she and Bill Murray had dated. I didn't realize that she had dated Brian Doyle Murray first.
Yeah, that I did not know. That's got to be weird come Thanksgiving, right? I mean, your brother, you got to see him.
sooner or later.
Exactly. Well, I mean, I guess they were cool with it. It was the 70s. Things were more loosey-goosey then, I guess.
I guess so. And that's the thing. I know we've talked about this, about Brian Doyle Murray. He's Bill's younger brother, yet he looks years and years older. I don't know how he did it.
Brian Doyle Murray, he's just got one of those faces. He seems like he's perpetually a middle-aged man.
Yeah, like he
middle-aged in the 70s, and he still like just seems middle-aged now, you know?
Yeah, I don't know. He just came out the womb middle-aged. He came out.
He was just born 47, I think.
Came out with a receding hairline and a pension.
Yes. But like a quote I love, this was one of Gilda's siblings who said this. Gilda told her that it was like really hard for her to see Ghostbusters because every guy in it of the main three had been her boyfriend at one point. Dan Aykroyd, Bill Murray, and Harold Ramis.
Again, I did not know. Well, I knew Bill Murray. I knew Aykroyd. I didn't know Ramis too. I was like,
yeah,
wow, she has a type.
But I mean, I can't imagine. Can you imagine like going to see a movie with like three of your ex-girlfriends starring in it?
No, I cannot.
That sounds like a special kind of nightmare.
Yeah, I don't want any part of that.
Even if they all like were good relationships and they all ended amicably, but
you'd constantly be like, "Oh, is she thinking about me when she said that line?" Is that
you would get knots in your stomach, man?
I feel like she's looking right at me. Did anybody else see that?
It's just so I'm sure that Gilda Radner's experience watching Ghostbusters was unlike anyone else's experience watching Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Which on one level is cool, and on another level is just kind of a shame, because it's like she can't enjoy this great comedy movie.
Yeah. And I think her sibling made it clear she did not date Rick Moranis. So that's...
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. Or Ernie Hudson, to my knowledge.
No. No.
Or Annie Potts.
No.
Or Sigourney Weaver, or Slimer, or Dean Yeager.
I think she did date the animatronic Zool, though. The dog creature thing.
Wow, there is no Dana, only Zool.
Yeah.
Wow.
But they had Cecily Strong read a quote from Gilda's diary where she says, being famous is almost as bad for dating as being funny. And you see Cecily Strong just kind of like nod and be like, yep, that's right.
It's like, yep.
she didn't really say anything, and she kind of didn't have to. She was just kind of like, yep, I feel you, Gilda, in that moment.
Yeah, because I mean, at this point, we realize like she is super famous now. She can't walk down the street without being recognized, but she also really wants to be in a relationship. She seems, I don't know. I mean, they never say it in the, in the show, but she seems a little codependent, I guess, in real life.
Yeah, that seems like a decent assessment.
Yeah, and there was also this one thing that I really liked when she tells a story that Amy Poehler reads, where she goes to the doctor for a physical exam.
Yes.
And the doctor left a note for her saying that he was a big fan and it was an honor to analyze her urine.
Yes.
Which... that's a level of fame that I think I want to get to.
And then they cut to Melissa McCarthy, who's like, yeah, I'm almost certain that's some sort of HIPAA violation.
I'm pretty sure you can't do that.
Yeah, that's not okay.
But yeah, Gilda found it charming enough to, I don't know, maybe the doctor was trying to be funny. I don't think he was,
I don't see how you could write that and not be, and be 100% serious.
Ms. Radner, I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, it is a honor and a privilege to analyze your urine.
Yeah, yeah. But Gilda Radner, she said, like, success doesn't really go with comedy, because comedy, you have to be kind of on the outside of people, and you have to be a bit of a voyeur to, like, observe people and come up with characters and things like that. And when you're super successful, you can't, like, anonymously look at people. People are looking at you.
Yeah, so. No, that's very true. I think I remember seeing an interview with, like, I think Zach Galifianakis kind of said that exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where, yeah, like, after The Hangover, it was hard for him to do comedy because, like, everybody's looking at you now. You can't just be the, gorilla in the mist lady looking at the gorillas.
Diane Fossey.
There it is. Fossey? Like, Fossey Vernon?
Not spelled the same way, but pronounced the same way.
Got it. Okay. But, yeah, you can't be on the outside looking in at these gorillas. because people, the girls are looking at you, and like you're, so you can't get that, you know, sort of that candid reaction that you would get from people.
I'm writing a book about you now, Diane Fossey. What do you think about that?
Ooh, that's right. Think, yeah.
I'm going to talk about your grooming habits now.
The Fossey Story by Mighty Joe Young.
They also talk about her character, Rosanna Dana, what a big hit that was, and how that kind of evolved. It sounds like that character is basically just built around the wig.
Yeah, she created that with writer Alan Zweibel. Mm-hmm. And
who's a producer on this film as well.
Right. And they basically say, oh yeah, she kind of put on this wig because it was a funny looking wig. And she kind of created the character around it to be kind of gross and disgusting as Rosanna Dana is wont to do. And she was able to take that and put it in the Weekend Update segment, and it just took off.
Mm-hmm.
It was pretty fantastic. That is definitely one of her more memorable characters. And yeah, you can see like the wig is definitely plays a huge part into why people find that character so funny.
Yeah, I mean that's one of her signature characters. That's like, you know, one of the top three things you think about when you think of Gilda Radner. Right. And I hadn't realized that Gilda Radner actually had won an Emmy for SNL.
Oh, yes, they did. She won an Emmy. I believe it was Linda Lavin that presented her with it?
No, it's Linda Carter.
Linda Carter. Who's Linda Lavin?
Linda Lavin was Alice. Linda Carter was Wonder Woman.
I get my Lindas mixed up. I apologize.
No. They both have dark hair, but that's about as far as the resemblances go. But
Linda Carter, Linda Lavin, Linda Rodstant. I get them all.
Big decade for Lindas.
That's right. The 70s were good to Lindas.
It was a golden age of Lindas.
Yes, we had Lindas as far as I could see.
I mean, do you get more 1970s than winning an Emmy that's presented to you by Linda Carter, by Wonder Woman?
That's my dream.
That's totally my dream.
Yeah, I would be wearing like a crushed velvet tuxedo going up.
Yeah, there you go.
Just frills galore.
Yeah.
Be like, hey, Linda, thanks, baby. Something like that. The biggest of afros. Some aviator sunglasses. I've thought about this.
You have this at the ready.
Yeah, just like a lot of rings, like Sammy Davis Jr. in his prime. Like I've thought about this. I've thought about it. I'm sorry. What were we talking about?
We were just talking about, you know, how awesome the 70s were.
They really were. I mean.
They kind of were, because, you know, it was the 70s. You could do all the drugs and have all the indiscriminate sex you wanted, and there weren't any what do they call them, consequences yet.
That's it. Yeah, you could just have a fun time, have a Rob Roy, do some blow, listen to Three Dog Night. It was a beautiful time.
Exactly. it was a wondrous time.
Oh,
you know,
it was great.
All the STDs were just like minor stuff that you could just clear up with a little penicillin.
Yeah, just wash your genitals in the sink and get a little penicillin shot. You'll be fine.
Exactly. Exactly.
Right. Four is bad.
Get right back out there, cowboy.
And that's right.
Studio 54 and do some more blow with Elton John or whoever.
That's right. Speed away in your Chevy Nova and just let the good times roll. Mama told me not to come. Dun, dun. That ain't the way to have fun, son. Do, 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 do,
do. You know, Han Solo? Some people say I look like him.
You can't see it, but I'm standing up and applauding right now.
God bless John C. Reilly. Man's a great.
Oh, God. Feel my heat.
So they also talk about her struggles with weight. She has because she's on television, she's under a lot of pressure to be thin. And like I said at the top of the show, she is disturbingly thin in a lot of this archival footage, you know?
Yeah, it's pretty rough. I think it's like at the time, I don't think anybody really had a name for it or knew what it was. Because I guess it was like around the same time, you know, Karen Carpenter was going through the same thing. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it was one of those things like no one knew about. They even say it. No one knew about like bulimia or anorexia or just eating disorders.
Yeah.
And at one point she says she had to go to the hospital because she weighed 104 pounds that she thought she was fat.
Yeah, that's so disturbing. Yeah, I remember in the Live from New York oral history book, Lorraine Newman, I think they talked about how, I think they were, for lack of a better term, like bulimia buddies. Like they would eat, they would like gorge themselves and then throw up. And
oh wow,
they didn't even have the term like bulimia then. She was just like, I didn't think of it as a sickness. I thought it was just like a neat trick we had.
Well, it was just a good time. Is that serious?
Well, it's just like, oh, it's this clever thing we do where, you know, we throw up after meals and then, you know, you don't gain the weight.
All right. Or you could just exercise. That's another way to do it.
Or, you know, eat a reasonable amount and not throw up.
Maybe let the metabolism burn off the calories and like a normal body's supposed to do. You know, a little jazzercise, something nice like that.
I mean, but it's, and this again is a thing where I kind of wanted them to get a little more in depth, you know?
Yeah, because I mean, they do a little bit because they also mention how at this point in SNL, like the cast is kind of looking to other things to do. Like Aykroyd and Belushi are off doing Blues Brothers. Are kind of they're kind of breaking away from SNL. So now that they were breaking away, people are looking to Gilda sort of fill that void. And she was like feeling the pressure of being, you know, the sweetheart of SNL and like to always like
look there was a lot more of the show on her shoulders, and at one point like she's like, I'm just one woman.
Yeah, that was heartbreaking. I was like, oh, Gilda.
So, you know, and that had to be tough. I mean, it's and you know, now we think of SNL as a thing where people come, people go. And it's not a big deal when any one person leaves, but with the original cast, there was no real precedent for it. It's like, you know, Belushi and Aykroyd leave, and then suddenly the cast is down to like five people.
Yeah, because
people, I think, because they added Harry Shearer that last season that Lauren was on, right. I think.
Oh yeah, that's right. But yeah, I think it was just one of these things where they just kind of started it not knowing where it would go or how big it would be. So once it became like this big machine, this profitable machine, that it was like, so now it's become this thing. How do we keep it going now once other people want to leave and do other stuff? Do we like replace? I guess it was like it's still in that phase where they're still trying to figure out how this machine works, I guess. Like how
And like when people start leaving the cast, it's like Sean Connery leaving James Bond.
Right, yeah.
And that's another thing. Like after that fifth season, like, everybody who was left from the original cast left all at once. So that had to be rough. Yeah, and Lorne leaves too.
Yeah. I mean, it was still rough when Chevy left after one season. Like, you know, he was kind of persona non grata after that. Everybody was like, dude, what are you doing? We're like a team. We're doing a thing here. We're all for one for all. And you're just going to go off to LA. And like, they were like, you know, fuck you, dude.
And he's like, yes, I am. There are like two good and lots of mediocre movies that have to be made, and I'm the guy to make them.
Oh, I wonder which ones you're talking about now.
Well, that's just off the top of my head. I may be a little off on the numbers there, but you know, we'll see. I'm sure we'll cover some Chevy Chase movies in the future.
Yeah. Oh yeah, we do have to do that. We haven't done a Chase movie yet, but.
I guess we haven't. Yeah, we've done Spies Like Us. And,
that's right. What am I saying?
And Spies. Three Amigos.
Oh, so we have.
But we haven't done any of his like solo starring vehicles where he's just like the guy.
Right, like Fletch and stuff. I hear you.
Fletch or Vacation or Memoirs of the Invisible Man.
Oh my God!
Yeah,
I may have to call it an audible and say no to that right now.
What, you don't want to see the Chevy Chase Daryl Hannah extravaganza with state of the art 1992 special effects?
No, sir, I don't think I do. No, thank you.
Okay.
Oh gosh. All right. So, so at this point, like we said, she's feeling burnt out, so she wants to sort of express her creativity in other ways, and then they get into this Gilda Live show she did at the Winter Garden Theater on Broadway. Where she
one woman show,
and I kind of remember this. I think I remember seeing this years ago, and though it was really pretty fantastic. Where like I said, it's like her doing all her characters. It's her doing some segments where she's like earnestly singing at some point. And, she has like a lot of her friends come on, Paul Schaefer come on and does like some musical pieces and whatnot. It was quite a performance from what I remember.
Mm-hmm.
I think they had like Don Novello come on at one point. I think there was like one segment where Father Guido Sarducci, you may know him better as, and yes. he does like,
and he was also a writer on SNL.
Oh yeah, he did that too. And it was kind of like a whole one woman thing, and just it was like her, like all her creative, all her work, all her creative writing, everything. It was all her, just right on the stage for all to see, and it went over extremely well from what I've read and what I've seen. But I think she also goes on to say at the end of it, she ended up kind of feeling a little empty, like it didn't kind of fill the void in her, which was,
And she said she kind of discovered from that she didn't really want to be a solo personality. So I guess because her career up until that point was working in all these various ensembles in like Godspell and Second City and Lemmings and SNL. So,
right.
So going to a thing where it's literally like a one woman show, that had to be a real adjustment.
Yeah, yeah, I think that, yeah, exactly. Yeah, she realized, oh, I want to be part of a group. I don't want to be like the star,
right?
Or whatnot. And I think also at this point, like SNL is starting to wind down, and I think she's been, a lot of people are kind of going off and doing other things, getting married and whatnot. I like that one segment they have where it was like the kind of the whole SNL gang getting together at this little place in downtown New York. I think it's called
Sandy. Yeah, this is when Alan Zweibel was marrying his wife, Robin, I believe.
Right. And then I think somebody's heard Gilda say, oh, no, I guess we got to be grown-ups now. We're growing up. We can't be like... Because I guess, in improv and acting and SNL, it's kind of like a prolonged adolescence where you just get to be, immature kids, forever. But, at a certain time, you got to, you can't be Peter Pan all your whole life. You got to grow up and... Like, I think that was kind of messing with her as well.
Yeah, yeah. And around this time, she gets engaged to G.E. Smith, who was the lead guitarist on her show Guilt Alive, and he's later became the musical director on SNL. So you probably know that. If you watched SNL from, like, the mid-'80s on, you remember G.E. Smith, because you were always seeing him going in and out of commercial breaks.
Yeah, the long hair, that smooth jacket, the fedora... Mm-hmm. Just tilted just so. I mean, the dude just oozes sex appeal.
He was a cool dude.
He was all types of cool.
I mean, I'm assuming he still is a cool dude. He's still around.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. He's still alive. He's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, not dead or nothing. But yeah, like when people heard that, she was getting married to G.E. Smith, they were quite surprised, because like I think a few people didn't even know they were dating, and when they got married, they were like, "Oh, that's okay. That's interesting." Because the two of them are very much polar opposites, which that's why that surprised a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. And also, like, they talk about how after she got married, they were like, oh, yeah, we didn't really see her anymore.
Yeah, that's I think, because also around this time.
I'm sorry, that's a little later. That's after she married Gene Wilder. I'm mixing up the marriages there.
Right. Well, we'll get there. We're getting there.
Because
like after she got married, that's when her contract to SNL was up, and she didn't renew it, and that's when her and everybody else left the show, and then she took a lot of time off to sort of kind of regroup and self-reflect and self-care, self-love,
because
I think she's been doing this thing for so long, she's burnt out on it, and she just kind of was trying to figure out what's her next move and just trying to sort of, I guess, get her mind right, which that's fair enough. I think Belushi did this kind of the same thing after SNL too.
Well, it seems like SNL is such an intense experience for anybody who does it, in any era. I think, you do need some time to just kind of decompress after you're done with it. Cause it's, it's such a crazy schedule too.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Just like, every Tuesday you stay up all night to write the show, and then you're rehearsing and performing the show. And then you only have one day Sunday to decompress. And I mean, it just sounds like such a grind.
Yeah, it's I mean, as glamorous as it all looks and how amazing it looks to be on SNL, it is, like you said, it is a grind. It don't come easy, to quote the great
I mean, I'm sure that most of the people who are on that show, they don't have a chance to have too much of a life outside of the show. I mean, I'm kind of impressed by anybody who's on SNL and is able to maintain any kind of like dating life or family relationships.
Yeah. I mean, because even now on SNL, there's a number of cast members that are married and some that have kids. So like, part of me is like, how do you juggle all that? Like,
yeah.
With the writing of the show. And I mean, of course you have like 3 week breaks like we're in now, but still like those weeks when you're on, it has got to be pretty grueling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I remember when they did the SNL at home shows about a year ago, I was kind of shocked to see that like Mikey Day had a young kid. And I'm just like, how do you do that? Oh my God.
You have a kid. How do you, well, how, you don't, you know where kids come from, right, John?
I'm hoping to find out some very, very soon. I'm keeping my fingers crossed. I think this is going to be the year.
This is it.
I'm going to find out where babies come from. I'm going to Google it, and I'm going to do this investigation, and I will report my findings here.
Please do. I think you're old enough. I think it's time.
Okay.
I think you're mature enough. I think you can handle it.
Okay. I'm looking forward to it. I've heard good things.
Oh, it's very good.
Okay.
All those things are good.
So by this point, we're getting into 1992, and Gilda Radner, she does a movie called Hanky Panky that stars Mr. Gene Wilder, the great Gene Wilder.
Yeah, because I think at this point he was kind of the it guy. Because
he was a big deal. I mean, because he had Willy Wonka. In like 1970, he had, and 74, he has a double shot of Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, which he also co-wrote, by the way. You know, and then later in the 70s, he has his collaborations with Richard Pryor. He's got Silver Streak and Stir Crazy.
Yeah, so he was that guy.
He was that guy. And they do this movie together. They hit it off. Gilda says, like, when she met Gene, she felt like her life went from black and white to Technicolor.
Yeah, and she immediately fell in love with Mr. Gene Wilder, so much so that she was like, oh, I guess I got to divorce G.E. Smith and get with Mr. Gene Wilder.
Yeah, they kind of gloss over that, like, because apparently she was still with G.E. Smith when she met Gene Wilder.
Yeah, so, yeah. That
you know,
part
I guess there was like an extramarital thing going on for a while, but they kind of play that down.
Yeah, they kind of are like, oh yeah, you know, something happened, and now she's with Gene Wilder. Yay!
Yay!
Love blooms.
And you know, and I mean, how can you dislike Gene Wilder? I mean, come on.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think at this point, this is the point where she starts going all in on the relationship and starts distancing herself from her old SNL cohorts and whatnot.
Yeah, yeah. Somebody said, like, Paul Schaefer says, like, yeah, Gene kind of took Gilda away from us.
Yeah,
he was a good thing for Gilda because he got her to, like, take care of herself more. And they say, like, he got her to eat.
Yes, eating is good.
Eating, that's good.
Yeah, nutrients. That's
nutrients.
A good thing. Who knew?
Survival.
Who knew? And also, Gilda was kind of getting into the things that Gene was getting into, like tennis. I guess Gene Wilder was a big tennis guy, so she got into that. French. I think she learned French for him.
Yeah.
Because Gene Wilder really loved France. And like, so yes, they were really like just like right off the rip, just like in it. They were just like in love.
Yeah.
All about it.
Yeah, it seems like they had a pretty intense relationship. Intense in the good way. It seems like a very healthy relationship.
Right, absolutely. And of course, you know, a few months later, they got married and, you know, and then after that, like, yeah, Gilda kind of totally just stepped away from the spotlight. She really wasn't she wasn't doing too many appearances. She wasn't doing too many moves. Well, no, we'll get into it, but she was just all in on this relationship. It was kind of reminding me of the same way that like after the Beatles broke up, like John Lennon was still making music, but he was like totally about being husband and dad to Sean and Yoko. Like he had
those about 5 years where he was just the house husband.
Right, exactly. So yeah, that's what Gilda kind of became, which that kind of popped in my mind.
Yeah, and they talk about she does another movie with Gene Wilder called Haunted Honeymoon, and she says that she actually puts off having a baby to star in this movie.
Right, but I think at one point she while they were shooting it, she did miss her. She was late. Mm-hmm. And so they took a pregnancy test, and she was pregnant, but unfortunately they had a miscarriage.
She has a miscarriage like 2 days later, like after. And then on top of that, after they finished the movie, which Gene Wilder also directed, and I'm assuming he wrote or co-wrote it.
He co-wrote it.
Okay. So when the movie's released, it gets horrible reviews.
Because when you mentioned this movie, this was a movie I remember seeing in the video store quite a bit.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing it on, TBS and the local, WPIX Channel 11 over here in New York stations quite a bit on like Sunday afternoons. But I never sat down to watch it.
I haven't seen that or Hanky Panky. I think both movies are pretty much forgotten today.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I'm looking at like Gilda's filmography, and she wasn't in too many. I don't want to say memorable movies. That seems mean. But she wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, because it's. I think really she's best remembered for her SNL work because she didn't really have a big hit outside the show. I mean, she had the Broadway show, but that's not the same as having like a hit TV show or a hit movie. It doesn't come to the entire country the way those things do.
Right. I mean, she was in a movie, First Family, then Hanky Panky, The Woman in Red, something called Movers and Shakers, and then Haunted Honeymoon. And that movie was critically panned by everybody.
Yeah, so...
They took that was a bit of a blow to their egos, and because they put a lot of work into it, and it was just not as loved as they hoped it would be. I guess again, to compare it to the Belushi thing, it's that thing where like when you're on SNL, everything you do is amazing to everybody. Everything just hits. Like anytime Belushi was on, the crowd would just love him. Anytime Gilda would do anything, the crowd would just love her. So like when they leave that and then they do these movies, I mean, for Belushi, he had some hit movies under his belt, but like when he did Neighbors or something like that, that was like the first thing where the audience was like, no, we don't like this. And like, so that is a bit of a blow to your ego where you're like, well, I've been knocking out the park every time I'm at bat. And so like you kind of maybe automatically think, yeah, everything I'm going to do, people are going to love. So that one time when you first do something that people don't love, it's like, it can hurt.
Yeah. And it can mess with your head too. Absolutely.
Right. Right. So. So at this point, they're kind of recovering from that. And, not too long after, Gilda's feeling kind of ill. She feels like, I think she says like something's wrong with her body. And then she goes to the doctor to get examined. And this is when she finds out, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer.
Yeah. And she goes through this sort of long recovery process for that. They talked about how when she was in the hospital, she like watched her own SNL episodes to kind of keep her spirits up.
Oh.
Which I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, it's like, you know who's going to lift up my spirits? Me.
Yeah.
Footage of me. But she definitely needed it because like she was falling in after she got diagnosed with this. She thought, oh, this is it. It's pretty much a death sentence. She fell into a pretty deep depression, just kind of stayed away from everybody. It was just at home with Gene, and she really didn't go out. She just, she was just kind of, shunned the outside world for a while. She was going through the chemotherapy, which was, took away a lot of her hair, which is kind of one of the things she's, I guess, I don't want to say known for, but it's one of her kind of noticeable traits because she had like a big head of hair, always had.
Yeah, she had that big 70s hair.
Yeah, so like when after that got taken away, you know, it was another knock to her esteem and everything. But she started to, you know, after being in this sort of depression for a while, she was starting to come out of it a little bit by going to a wellness community meetings, and she was starting to like kind of make jokes a little bit with the people within the meetings who were, you know, going through recovery as well, and she was able to kind of find her light again. There's actually footage of her that they show of her, you know, in the hospital going through chemo, getting visited by Gene Wilder, you know, bringing their small little dog, and like them kind of cracking.
Yeah, their dog Sparkles.
Sparkles. That's a great name for a dog.
Especially, it's like this little cute. What breed was it? I'm not quite sure.
I don't know. It's just like one of those little pocketbook dogs, like those purse dogs.
Exactly. Exactly.
Like the dog you see in the Upper West Side. It's like, you know.
Right.
Like one of those dogs. So, so, you know, through that, they start to sort of start to laugh again and, you know, find the laughter. So then after 5 months of that, she gets back home. She's out of the hospital. She's feeling better. She's in remission. And she's starting to kind of, I don't know, I guess like maybe miss the spotlight a little bit, because she reaches out to her good friend, Alan Zweibel, saying, you know, like, I feel like I want to, you know, do something, because like, you know, the only way to kind of get me out of this situation is to make jokes about it. You know, my jokes are my only weapon against this cancer. And Zweibel was at the time working on It's Gary Shandling Show, which, folks, yeah, if you haven't seen It's Gary Shandling Show, I highly recommend you watch It's Gary Shandling Show.
Yeah, it's a little overlooked these days because I think it's overshadowed a bit by the Larry Sanders Show, which Gary Shandling did in the 90s. But back in the 80s, he did this show, It's Gary Shandling Show, which was a very unusual format for the time. It was, I mean, he was playing himself on the show, but he was also aware that he had a show. So he would commonly talk to the camera and do all these fourth wall breaking things.
Yeah, I remember. So this came out in 88. So I was like 11. And I remember watching the show thinking, oh, wow, this is, because this show was like meta on top of meta on top of meta. It was just like a big old, like a double decker of meta. Like, yeah, like you said, it was kind of like Seinfeld a little bit, the format, but it's like you said, like him looking into the camera, him breaking the fourth wall constantly, talking right to the audience, talking right into the camera.
Right.
And I mean, they were just like kind of setting up the tropes of sitcoms, then bringing in just, you know, guest stars out of nowhere and be like, oh, hey, it's so-and-so. Like it was,
yeah, and he'd be like, oh, well, it's time for me to go to the next scene. And he would like literally walk off the set and walk onto the next set on camera.
Right. I mean, the theme song to Gary Shandling Show is fantastic because it's literally just a guy saying, hey, this is the theme, the Gary Show. The theme, the Gary Show.
Gary called me up and asked if I could write his theme song. I'm almost halfway finished. What do you think of it so far? How do you like the theme, the Gary Show? It's a catchy tune, too.
It is. Like, if you love meta, I highly recommend you watch It's Gary Shandling Show. I think it's only on DVD now. I don't think it's streaming anywhere.
Yeah, you probably find some clips on YouTube, I would imagine, though.
Right. But, yeah, so that is my TED Talk on It's Gary Shandling Show. Thank you.
Yes.
Two thumbs up. Way up.
Yes.
All right, so Alan Zweibel, back to Zweibel, he was saying, well, yeah, come on Gary Shandling Show, and we'll riff, and I'll write you something for the show. And I think at the time, Gilda was like, well, I haven't been on TV in 6 or 7 years. I don't even know if people will remember me.
Yeah.
I'm like part of a bygone era. You know, she kind of felt like she's past her prime at this point.
Yeah. And she's only, you know, like maybe 40 on the outside at this point. God. Yeah. It's a sad thing to feel like you're a has-been at 40.
Oof.
But they showed her coming out. Oh, well. It's even sadder to be a never was at 40.
Wow. I beg your pardon, sir. You are the co-host of the SNL Nerds podcast, need I remind you.
Well, this is true. This is true.
Come on.
Have
some pride, man.
Okay, no time to unpack all my issues. But they show Gilda Radner coming out on on It's Gary Shandling Show, and Gary Shandling is like, oh, hey, it's Gilda Radner. And the sustained applause that she gets from the audience, it is nuts, man.
Yeah. Because
they just love her. You can just feel the affection coming through your screen.
Right. Yeah. You can see her like a genuine look of just like gratitude and joy and just love just washes over her. And it's a pretty heartwarming thing to see.
Yeah. And she like, you know, turns to the audience and she like puts her arms up and waves. And I think Gary Shandling says something about like, okay, you know, you're milking it now.
Yeah. And then I think Gary goes on and say, hey, we haven't seen you around. Gilda, how have you been? And she's like, oh, you know, I had cancer. What did you have?
And he just says, oh, well, I just had a series of bad career moves.
That's fantastic.
That's so great. I mean, that's so Gary Shandling. And I miss both of those people so much.
Yeah. Oh, Lord. Both those people are fantastic.
You know,
like, I think even
wish they were both still with us.
Damn straight. Because I think even they were saying, yeah, like, making fun of having cancer, that's just something you didn't do. I mean, people don't even do it now.
Like, no, I mean, it really wasn't done back then. So she really she found the humor of it and she took a lot of stigma out of it. And I think she helped a lot of people to deal with that.
Right. So yeah, she kind of had a bit of a resurgence, but I mean, unfortunately it was short-lived because this is where the documentary kind of wraps up things a little too quickly, I thought, where they did mention that the cancer did come back.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unfortunately it was like, you know, the fatal one. And, you know, she passed away, a year later in 1989.
Yeah.
And, she came out with her autobiography, It's Always Something, which was published 2 weeks after her death in 1989.
Yeah. Yeah. And in, 1995, Gene Wilder and, Joanna Bull opened the first Gilda's Club in New York, which is a organization that helps people with cancer and their friends and families. And now there are 17 Gilda's Clubs in the U.S. and Canada.
Right. Yeah. There's one in New York, I think like downtown, like around, what is it? Like kind of near Canal Street, like almost Tribeca, but not, I guess it's like maybe like NoHo or SoHo. I remember always walking by it once in a while and like seeing it. I was like, oh yeah, it's Gilda's place. Oh yeah. Every time I walked by it, I was like, I had, you know, put a little smile in my heart.
Smile in your heart and a spring in your step.
That's right. Put a little love in your heart.
So yeah. So, I mean, it's a nice legacy to have. You know, overall, I thought this documentary was well done, but it felt a little incomplete in places. I mean, like there are some places where it feels like they're glossing over stuff, and there are some notable exceptions to who they talk to. Like, you know, I would have loved to have Bill Murray in there, or if they found some on-camera footage of Gene Wilder talking about Gilda Moore, you know?
Yeah.
Like after she passed or something.
Yeah, I kind of know what you mean.
G.E. Smith.
You know? Yeah, they didn't talk
to him. One of her husbands, and they don't talk to him for whatever reason. Maybe they asked and he refused. But
yeah.
You wish they could have found a little more and talked to a little more people. And I mean, I would have loved if this had been closer to 2 hours. I mean, as it is, it's only like 86 minutes. So you feel like at times they're just kind of skimming the surface.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. I mean, I thought this was a good doc, but it does feel like it needs to be, you know, beefed up a little bit more. Like, like you said, like maybe some interviews with her past, you know, husbands like G. Smith, or maybe some of the other writers she worked with. Like, Rosie Schuster did get interviewed. But I don't know. It does feel like it needs a little bit more. Maybe the family didn't want some stuff to get out. Maybe they had some say into what did and did not go into the doc. Maybe that's it. Maybe they reached out to other people. Maybe they reached out to people that they really wanted to talk to, but, you know, like you said, maybe they didn't want to talk. But it does feel a little like, it feels like a scratching the surface.
You know, and I can certainly sympathize with what the problems must have been, because I'm working on a book project that's like an oral history thing, and you're just limited by the people who are willing to talk to you or the people that you can get in touch with in the time that you're allotted. So, I mean, there are limitations, but yeah, you wish it could have been a little more comprehensive, a little more in depth at all, you know, cause she's an interesting subject. You want to find out more about her.
Yeah. I mean, to this day, people just love her. Like when you think about, you know, the SNL cast members, like who stand tall in the history halls of SNL, like she's one of the first performers you think of.
Mm-hmm.
So to have, you know, this be, I don't know, is this like one of the only docs out there about her or?
About her? I mean, as far as I know, yeah.
Yeah, so for this to be the only thing, it's like, it feels like it's not enough. It feels like,
I mean, it's a good primer, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. But I wish, you know, I just keep thinking, like, they said they had 32 hours of audio cassette tapes, and you just think, okay, yeah, I know that some of those were damaged beyond repair, but you'd think you could have gotten a little more, especially, you know, you also had access to her journals and her writings, and you had the SNL cast members and hosts reading those. I don't know. There's just a lot of fascinating stuff, and I just wish we could have gotten even more of it.
Yeah. So I think overall, we think it's good, but it could have been better. It needed to be good. It's worth seeing.
I wouldn't say it's as good as, you know, the Belushi documentary or the Phil Hartman documentary, Last Days of Phil Hartman, that we've watched for this show.
That's right. Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right. We did. But yeah, we thought this was good. So it's out on Hulu right now.
Mm-hmm.
Go watch it. Let us know what you think. And yep. Speaking of which, I tweeted out that we were doing this doc today, and we actually did get a response about it from our good friend Steve Harold at Joint Partners about it.
Oh, cool, cool. I don't think I've seen this. I've had a little trouble with the Twitter lately, so this will be new to me.
All right, so Steve says, saw this in theaters. She was the best. A few years ago, I went back to watch the original 5 seasons. One of the things that caught my attention about her was it seemed like she never used the cue cards. I started watching to try and catch her using them, and I'm sure she was, but she seemed so good at it, I never felt like she was. She wasn't locked on them like so many others are. She reminded me of Martin Short in a way, where Hollywood didn't seem to know what to do with her after the show. It's a shame she didn't live to possibly do the cable show they talked about after her appearance on It's Gary Shandling Show. I would have loved to have seen that.
Hey, okay, and that's the thing that's not even mentioned in the doc.
Yeah, like the cable show? I didn't know about that until I just read it just now. Like,
no, yeah, that's new to me, so...
Yeah, so again,
maybe, you know, because from what they make it sound like her health went on a downturn like not too long after that. So, I mean, but maybe they're collapsing things together. I don't know.
Well, I mean, Gary Shandling came out in 88. It only lasted one season. Then she passed away in 89. So, yeah.
That was only one season, really?
That's what I'm seeing here.
Hmm.
I can see
it. It was like 86 that show started.
No, 88. It was definitely late 80s. Because, like, I remember, yeah, I was like, oh, wait, no. It's Gary Shandling Show. Oh, wait, maybe it's 86. Why did you only see one season? I don't know what I'm doing, guys. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Wait, no, it says, yeah, 86 to 90. All right, my mistake.
Okay.
My mistake. Our corrections department will take care of that. We'll fix that in post.
Okay.
Huh. Okay. All right, so, yeah, 86 to 90. My mistake. But, yeah, like, I didn't know she was going to do a cable show. That would have been fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. But,
oof. No, yeah, this, we ended on a bummer, guys. So, yeah.
So, but, I mean, definitely worth seeing, though.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, if anything, it does capture kind of the essence and, you know, the light. And it really encapsulates what Gilda was about, what she brought to the show, what she, mm-hmm. you know, how she elevated SNL and how beloved she was just by like so many people. You get a good sense of knowing what all the hoopla was about with her and see she lived up to it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And and that's our episode, guys. Thanks so much for listening as always. As always, you can follow us on Twitter at SNL Nerds Show. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Darren Credible. That's D-A-R-I-N Credible.
And you can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Trumbull Comic, T-R-U-M-B-U-L-L, and the word comic. And next week, it's another off week for SNL. So we're going to do another project from an SNL alum. It's one that's been getting a lot of nice press lately. It's a little something that Mr. Jason Sudeikis has been up to.
That's right. I recently, I think I talked about it on this podcast, and I kind of rambled on about it a little bit, mm-hmm. where I was, I kind of, because it came out last year on Apple TV in October. I think I watched it a couple months later after I got Apple TV, and I was like, wow, this show's really good. And then I hopped on the microphone, and on an episode, I just babbled on about how much I love the show. So now we're going to deep dive into it. Ladies and gentlemen, we're doing Ted Lasso.
Ted Lasso, yeah. And since then, I've gotten started on Ted Lasso. I'm not finished with it quite yet, but yeah, we decided I'll finish it up this week, and then we'll talk all about Ted Lasso next week.
Mm-hmm. I think you're going to like, what episode are you up to right now?
I'm probably around episode 5 or 6. I'm somewhere around halfway through the show.
Ooh, okay. All right. Don't tell me what you think. I want to get all of it, all of it in my ears when we record next week.
I will put it all up in your ear holes. Yes. When we record next week.
I'm waiting with bated breath. Baiting breath? Baited breath.
Baited.
Baited. Breath. Baited.
Baited. Plan.
Plan.
Not plan. Plan.
Plan. Plan. The lock. The lock.
So, next week, we're going to Ted Lasso up in this joint.
That's right. So, yeah, I guess that's our episode, guys. Thanks again for listening, as always. And is there anything else we gotta say? I think
rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the podcast. That does help. Please let your friends know about the show. We're always looking to get some more listeners. Retweet the show when we share it. And let us know what you think on the Twitter, because we always like hearing back from people.
Yeah, spread the word, Mockingbird.
Otherwise, we're just screaming into the void.
That's right. Let us know if this isn't going on deaf ears. Our rambling and our listen to people. Let us know.
Yes. Yes.
For the love of Pete.
So, I think that's it. So we'll see you next week for Ted Lasso. But until then, Nerds Out.
This has been a non-productive media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.